Just a moment. Just a moment.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast, exploring where the law has been.
Hey Siri, take a selfie.
And where it's going.
Oh, good afternoon.
From the brilliant.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot.
To the scary.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
And everything in between. Please welcome your very real and very human host, Mike Madison.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast. This is your host, Professor Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Talking about the future of law often means talking intergenerationally. That is, talking about looking to the emerging generation of lawyers and legal professionals to drive innovation and change rather than expecting incumbent practitioners to improve legal systems. But the intergenerational move requires that we do more than simply wait for newer, fresher faces to enter the field. It also requires that the profession engage in teaching and training new lawyers in ways that include and support them effectively as they begin careers in law offices, law firms, law departments, and other organizations. That means creating paths to success that help new lawyers learn how to navigate organizational cultures and expectations and how to develop and use effective interpersonal skills. My guest today is a lawyer turned entrepreneur who is focused on precisely that gap. And that's what it is, a gap, which exists between traditional, stereotypical, supervisory practices that expect new lawyers to figure things out on their own and law school programs that still focus, as they long have, on analytic skills like legal reasoning and classic advocacy skills developed in law clinics. Her name is Krista Contino Sombi, and I first met her years ago as a star student at my law school in Pittsburgh. After a first career as a patent lawyer, she has turned her attention to training the new generation via a venture that she calls the Law Bridge. It's a bridge to the future for new lawyers, which means that it's part of the future of law. Krista, it's great to see you again. Welcome to the Future Law Podcast.
It's so nice to see you, Professor Madison.
Oh, don't go there. So you have a new venture. You have a new venture, the Law Bridge. Tell us about that.
I am very excited to talk to you about that. I started this new venture last March. So the middle of a pandemic is a great time to start something new, I guess. Everybody learned something new or they took care of themselves, and either way is good. But what I wanted to do, I've been wanting to do for a really long time, which is help law students become good attorneys. And so that's what I really am looking to do for different legal organizations. It's been awesome to work with legal departments and law firms to look at their particular requirements of their associates, because as much as the law is the law, if you stand up in court, you have to do particular things. Each culture of an organization is going to be different. And as you know, I might talk later about, I've had experiences in different organizations. Each one has its own flavor. And I don't know if this is something that's come across your world, although you're probably one of the more curious people I know on the planet. But the first 3 years an attorney is working in a law firm, it's lost money, lost capital, which is not so surprising how much a lawyer is making the first year. But after a while, and especially considering the number of hours that attorneys work, you know, from day one, that 3 years is nothing. Doesn't make much sense to me, especially if you can take a chunk of time and make it way more efficient and say, hey, this is what everyone wants from you. These are go ahead.
I was going to say, so you're trying to figure out how to help legal organizations make those early years more productive and valued from the organization standpoint, but also make them more effective learning experiences from the new lawyer standpoint.
Exactly. My first day in my first law firm, I was making oatmeal. It was very exciting. And one of the more senior associates was kind enough to say, I just want to tell you, you seem really nice and really smart. This entire year, you're going to be stupid. And to me, that is just hazing. I mean, he was nice enough to let me know it was happening. So that was good. And I will always appreciate that. But the way that law firms just expect you to read minds is inefficient and slightly archaic. So why not change things?
So get into some of the details. Like, so when we talk about creating what sounds essentially is a bridge program, which is obviously why you've called it the Law Bridge.
That, and I like this puns.
This is content that law schools traditionally have not taught. And maybe back in the day, maybe back when I graduated from law school decades ago, different century, literally, maybe law firms were better at having structured experiences for new lawyers. But now the economics of the law firm world don't support that on a systematic basis. Law schools haven't really evolved to fill up that space. So you've got that gap. That's where you're speaking. And what kind of content do you put there?
Well, I think that the other thing that was different was that attorneys went to firms where they already had a network in it. Like people, if they moved, they moved and they got a job because this person was also an alumni of the same school. There was a common ground that happened. And now because of how much people will move for positions, there's less of a chance that there's going to be that synergy, as well as the concept of diverse attorneys having that extra barrier necessarily. Even if you have somebody coming in from the military going into a law firm, that's a huge culture shift. It just is. So what I do is that I work with a particular group and say, okay, so tell me what's going on with your associates. And I talk to different associates and I figure things out. And I also then have to go, okay, so who's doing well at what? And I learn just as much from the folks who aren't doing as well as I do from the people who are doing well, because it will surprise a lot of people what isn't okay, because it would be perfectly fine at another firm. So teasing that out and allowing it so that there's that idea of what success is, because, you know, we all have different ideas of what success is, but that style and that extra shine can really help somebody who is dedicated and motivated and hardworking cut through some of the other things that they just wouldn't know otherwise. And I read an article, it was called The Invisible Furniture in the Room. And what I'm hoping to do is make sure you don't bump your shins any more than you have to.
So this is not technical lawyering skills. This is social, cultural awareness, collaboration skills, social intelligence, the networks that are there that you may not be even aware of because of your own personal background, experience, training, and so forth.
How different staff help things? How do things run? What does this paralegal do versus this paralegal? And everything from, hey, this partner won't let you take notes when you're sitting in the room.
Wow. Yeah. There are partners who won't let you take notes?
There were teachers that didn't let me take notes.
Ah, I might know one of those. But I pause over your saying that only because I remember one of the things that's changed, again, my experience as a law student decades ago, is that in the 1980s, well through the 1990s, even into the beginning of the 2000s, up to about 2008, for obvious reasons, lots of law firms had large summer programs where it was common for many students at many law schools, not just the elite law schools, to spend at least one summer and sometimes more than one summer interning or clerking for a law firm and getting acquainted with that firm and its cultures and practices as a precondition to getting a permanent job offer. After 2008, a trend that was already in motion accelerated, and a lot of the larger sized summer internship programs have disappeared. Mm-hmm. And so the economics of law practice have changed. And so opportunities for law students to have those kinds of exposures to organizational culture before they come on board as a full-time lawyer, fewer of those opportunities exist across the board. And so you made the comment about note-taking. I'm just reminded of an experience I had in one of my summer positions when I was in law school, where I walked into a partner's office for a conversation about a new research assignment, and I had a pen and nothing else in my hand. And the first thing that the partner said is never walk into a partner's office without a legal pad. And he flamboyantly opened the top drawer to his desk where he had a stack of blank legal pads, took one out, and he was very classy and polite about the whole thing. He put it on his desk in front of me so that I could take notes of my conversation with him. But it's one of those micro lessons that stick with you. I have never forgotten that moment. That person went, I took a job with that firm after I graduated, and that person ended up being a nice mentor to me for several years. But that sounds like it's the kind of experience and knowledge that's much more difficult to come by in a lot of settings for new lawyers, no matter where they start work.
Exactly. And I think that the other issue that we run across, especially with issues of diversity and retention, is that when you have somebody who's a first generation attorney or first generation college student, as we were talking earlier, the fear of being quote unquote found out and the level of imposter syndrome is even higher. So the likelihood of asking somebody for help is so much lower because there doesn't seem to be somebody to ask.
So it's a kind of double bind. You feel excluded, and you're also excluded from resources that you might otherwise draw on to get acclimated and understand what's going on. For the moment, let's shift gears a little bit. And I want to ask you about your own career. So you graduated from my law school years ago. You were in my courses. Back then, you were an aspiring patent lawyer. So I'm curious about your career path from that point. What brought you to the point where you wanted to start your own venture?
Well, until February, I was a patent attorney. So I guess I did what I said I was going to do. So you were talking about how 2008 changed things, and I graduated in 2007. I was a summer associate for Fish and Richardson up in Minnesota and ended up working for them. For 1 year, I was a Thorpe Reed doesn't exist anymore, if I'm correct.
Not as a standalone firm.
Okay. So that was where I spent my first year summer. But after that, moved to Minnesota, worked there for 2 years for Fish and Richardson, ended up going to Los Angeles for Morrison Foerster, still behaving like a good patent attorney, did prosecution and litigation back when they let you do both, and then moved back to Minnesota because of family things and started up my own law firm for almost an entire year before I got tapped by Judge Reyna, who asked me to be his first law clerk at the Federal Circuit. That was an experience and very exciting. And after that, I lived in DC and worked as a patent attorney, ended up working for the patent office as an examiner for a few years, and then saw that things were going to get even harder for patent examiners and decided to change the scenery, as I often do.
A change of scenery. Time for another reboot. So, but you rebooted in a completely novel direction. You became an entrepreneur. You saw a gap in a certain market, and you decided that this was the right moment to address it, and that you were the person to do that. So, what prompted you to go in the entrepreneurial direction rather than to carry on in a new genre of patent practice or some other form of law practice?
I think it was just simply I've had enough knowledge of who I am that I know I need to focus on one thing at a time, for starters. Second, I know that I want to serve my clients, whoever they are, in my full capacity. And I've done the litigation and prosecution at the same time. I was doing an ITC case my first year, along with a full docket of writing patents, and the 3 hours of sleep doesn't work anymore. So, I really wanted to focus on that. I realized it was what I was interested in. Since 2006, I had been an active member of the Hispanic National Bar Association. And so a lot of the things that I've learned over the years and watched folks experience has also come from watching my mentees struggle, watching my colleagues struggle, seeing that even the folks that are my mentors not really understanding why things aren't working or more efficient. And also a year before I came to law school, I was an industrial engineer for Procter & Gamble. So I need to make things more efficient. It's part of who I am.
that's entirely justified and understandable. And it gets to something that we were talking about offline before we started to record, which is about the integration of your professional identity and other identities. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your pathway in with your engineering history, your law school ambitions, and what you experienced in the practice of law, and including clerking for Judge Reyna.
Sure. So I would say one of the things that I kind of talked about, I wrote an article recently in LinkedIn. I don't know if you had a chance to check that out.
We'll put it on the podcast website.
How could you? But it was for Pride Month, and it talked about intersectionality. And so when I first walked into Carnegie Mellon and sat down in an engineering class, I was very often the only woman in the room because it was electrical and computer engineering. There just weren't women in that department. I had one female professor in that department the entire time, and she was a visiting professor. So that was an awkward moment. And then, or 12. And then there was also the fact that I was disabled. So that was another set of circumstances that often led to fighting with administration or different situations so that I could get proper accommodations for things like testing. And then I also had to cope with the fact that I have an autoimmune disorder. So, you know, professors, you don't get to take a test if you're not feeling well. You don't get to like try and figure out when to do that again in law school. You just kind of have to figure out how to do it, period. So those things really did color my situation, along with having a father who is Hispanic and dark-skinned. I very much pass as white. I am white, but my father does not get the same treatment by random people off the street that I do. So having that as a, since I was a child, we lived 10 minutes outside of Ferguson, Missouri, if that gives you an idea.
Okay.
That really made impressions throughout my life. So with all those different experiences, that this past June, I finally decided to come out openly. I'd like to think that that makes a little more sense because, you know, if you only can tick so many boxes before your hand gets tired for diversity. I used to make the joke when people would ask me to be part of women's groups in law, I'd say, I'm sorry, I only have time to be Hispanic.
But this whole, that's really fascinating, and I'm grateful that you're willing to share all of that. One of the things it speaks to in many different ways is how conversations around the future of the legal profession, by which I mean not only the far distant future, but also the immediate future, typically focus around technology. Mm-hmm. So we really haven't yet in the podcast talked about any ways in which modern information technologies have affected the practice experience, the economics of law practice, dynamics between law firms and clients, or how courts operate, for example. The conversation almost never does what we're talking about now, which is talk about how to create conditions for success to make the legal profession welcoming and accessible to the next generation of people who we want to become lawyers, and how to help those people succeed, which are questions that are foundational. They have always been there. They have never gotten the attention that they deserve. And now they're getting kind of crushed by questions about technology, which can create a whole nother layer of obstacle and barrier. Your experience as an undergraduate at Carnegie Mellon being kind of exhibit one for our purposes. So I'm really grateful that you raised these topics, because it's really something that I think is important in the context of everything else to talk about. Yes, we have to understand how technology is functioning. Yes, we have to understand how technology will improve or affect access to justice conditions across wide populations. But we also have to make sure that we are not continuing to exclude big populations of people who have historically been excluded from succeeding and being effective as lawyers. And that sounds like that's the gap that you're speaking to from your own experience and that you're trying to address in terms of the Law Bridge.
Yeah, I will say I was very lucky in particular at a couple firms where people were as accommodating as they could be for various reasons. When I became very ill, and I'm just going to be open about that, in 2012, 2013, I was very sick and I couldn't travel on the metro without getting sick. So I was wearing face masks before it was cool. But But I did actually have to change firms entirely and take a different path just because of health reasons, even though the firm that I was leaving was honestly upset about the whole fact that I had to leave and trying to figure out a way to keep me. They just couldn't. It just didn't work with how their business was run. And I still keep in contact with folks. They're very good people. They let me stay on with one of their pro bono cases, which was fantastic to be able to help out. But there isn't room, no matter how good of an attorney you are necessarily, if you can't fit certain requirements of physical abilities.
Law firms have their traditional expectations in many respects.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the Law Bridge and tell us a little bit about how this initiative has been received. How what kind of reactions have you gotten and what kind of uptake have you gotten from law firms, law schools, other legal organizations?
Well, I got welcomed pretty quickly by folks that I've already worked with, which doesn't surprise anyone. You know, if you do a good job the first time, usually people don't mind coming back for seconds, unless you did too good of a job and they don't need you anymore, what have you. But I've worked with some folks in the Hispanic National Bar Association, and through that, some folks at Microsoft. Like I was telling you earlier, I'm working on a video right now that I need to edit. It's so weird to have to edit, I think, for probably both of us in some respects. But
as a law student, I never thought I would become a podcast editor, but here I am. and you're a podcaster too, so you and I share that novel skill.
It's a wacky world. I wouldn't have thought about it working, you know, doing AOL dial-up back in the day. But yeah, I have been really fortunate in that. I've spoken to some groups regarding diversity. It's been a little bit more wider than I initially thought. So I'll say that the students that I've had, and that's who I talk about, if I talk about that, that's the new attorneys, have probably been the most vocal about their thanks, which is, to me, of course, what I want at the end of the day. That's why I do what I do. The paychecks are always nice, but also, you know, you don't just do a job like this because the money is so good. and I think I hear a lot of thank you for being honest more than I'd like to hear. And it's not so much that like, oh, law firms are terrible places to work, but it's just one of the things that I got told in career services, and with the best of intentions, I'm sure, is when you turn in a work product, ask how you did and then ask what you could do better. Well, I asked how I did, and the partner says, you did great. Well, was there anything you want me to change? No, it was great. Well, are you sure? If you ask me that again, I'll find everything wrong with it.
Ooh.
Oh, I've just made him mad.
Yeah. Yeah. So how to learn to navigate conversations like that more productively.
Exactly. And just making it easier. There was a person who had worked in government for a really long time and then got a job in a law firm and did not understand that there was no training in law firms to teach you how to write a memo. You just did it.
Yep.
And thought that the partner was just mean and angry and spiteful. And I had to sit them down and talk them off the ledge and go, no. This is what it's going to be like.
Well, so law firms have for a long time, as you know, you experienced this, they operate, especially in the U.S. I don't want to be overgeneralizing because I know that cultures vary a lot from country to country. Legal systems, business systems vary as well. But in the U.S., a lot of law firms for a long time have operated on a presumption that we hired ambitious, talented, energetic, smart new lawyers. It's reasonable for us to expect them to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I was in high school, I had a soccer coach who was disabled, and he was a great coach. His motto was figure it out. And he was very effective at saying that because he had been a very successful college football player. He knew nothing about soccer, which is my sport.
Mm-hmm.
He had no hands. He was born without hands. He could tie his shoes. he could play the trombone. He drove us in the van to away games. So when he said to us, figure it out, we listened. But what you appreciate as an adult, you don't necessarily appreciate when you're 16 years old, is that to say to somebody, figure it out, makes an enormous number of assumptions about capability, competence, and all kinds of other things that can be taken for granted and not ought not to be taken for granted. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, especially about law schools and legal education, and whether you've made any headway in talking with career services offices, professional services offices, about how to update their mentorship programs, their training programs, in terms of how they advise students in looking for jobs, interviewing for jobs, preparing to enter the job market.
I have been pretty lucky in that the folks that I have talked to are interested in me necessarily providing that input myself, hiring me on as a consultant or just to be a speaker. So that's, you know, fairly new company in the works, as you might imagine, because law schools are even slower to adapt necessarily than some law firms. I say with all the love in my heart for Pitt.
Oh, that's okay. But it's also true that law schools are even more stretched for cash in most contexts than law firms are. And that's not to stereotype law firms as flush with cash. The cash is just a scarce resource for everybody these days.
Yeah.
Let's pivot for the last part of the podcast to talk about the future. The future for you, the future for your venture, but also the future for the legal profession and the legal sector generally. So where do you want to take your initiative? Where do you want the Law Bridge to be in 5-8 years? What do you want the legal landscape to look like by virtue of your intervention and maybe others like it?
What I'm hoping is that as I go along, these structures exist so that somebody that I've helped is the person that's hiring me, and that these transitions become smoother, because no one's going to go into a job and know exactly what they're supposed to do. It just doesn't happen. Even as engineers go in and they do know exactly what they're supposed to do necessarily, there's going to be a transition. There's going to be a change. I went from one law firm to another doing the exact same job, but cultural differences exist. So something that I do is probably going to help anybody changing from one culture to another. At the same time, I just want it to be less terrifying and less shocking that we explain to students it's going to be different. There are going to be different expectations. Some of them aren't going to make sense to you, and that's okay.
Give people more confidence that they can handle some of the unknown.
Exactly, exactly. And that we also sort of put in the mix to folks who are in leadership, hey, maybe this person isn't perfect, not because they aren't trying, but because you're not giving them the same tools as this other person who was born with them.
And get people to think a bit entrepreneurially. I'm going to use that word. Again, you're a bit of a model for others in a different respect, right? That you were an engineer, then a lawyer, now you're an entrepreneur. There's a progression in terms of functions and skills, but there's also an evolution in terms of your identity and your imagination about yourself.
I will say that I had two businesses before this. So it's kind of in my blood too. My mom's family is full of entrepreneurs, so I'm a little less risk averse than the average attorney, but I definitely suggest learning to overcome that fear in various ways for any person who's an attorney, because that's just part of any business whatsoever.
In a sense, the legal community is not quite so different than many other sectors of the economy, right? So before we went on the air, I was remembering that back in my day, people went to law school, and it was pretty accepted that you would graduate from law school, take a job with a law office or a law firm, and expect a pretty comfortable, stable, secure career from that point forward, so long as you behaved ethically, served your clients, and worked a reasonable number of hours. It was a good, safe career at a relatively high level. That characterization has shifted a lot over the last 30 years. It's especially shifted over the last decade, post 2008, so that going into a legal career is no longer the reliably safe, secure pathway that it once was. So people become entrepreneurially minded out of necessity, if not by choice, and you're helping to guide them in some of those exercises.
Yeah, and I think the other part of that is that what I'm hoping to do, particularly with the classes when it's a legal department, is say, look around these people. You may not be working with them in the same position for very long, but they might be going to in-house counsel, or you might be the person that they're going to hire. So for whatever reason or vice versa, you want to make sure that those connections are solid and secure, and everyone you know is going to either help or not help your career. Why not make it the former rather than the latter?
Krista, this has been great. It's been super interesting to reconnect, super interesting to hear what you're up to. And I want to thank you and wish you all the success in your new venture.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you again.
Thank you for listening to the Future Law Podcast. For links to the articles mentioned and to contact the hosts, visit futurelawpodcast.com.